Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Take your pick for the theme of the program today. You really can't always get what you want, or economic policy is hard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 7th of March, good as always to have you along, everybody. It was less than a week ago that President Trump announced, pretty much out of nowhere in normal policymaking terms, that he was going to impose 25% across-the-board tariffs on imported steel and 10% on aluminum. There has been much speculation and public urging since, a lot of it from his fellow Republicans, that the president ought to change his mind, or at the very least, target those tariffs a little bit. The White House has been steadfast. The president himself has said that the tariffs would happen as announced. Until today. Here is Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders with the opening stanzas of the Washington walk back.
We expect that the president will sign something by the end of the week, and there are potential carve-outs for Mexico and Canada based on national security and possibly other countries as well based on that process.
Tomorrow, by the way, is the latest we're hearing from the White House on when those things are going to be signed. But one of the reasons that Republicans in particular have been pushing back against these tariffs is that they're not really compatible with another key item on the Trump economic agenda, his tax cuts. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains policymaking is hard, especially when there is economic inconsistency.
Governing is tricky. Solve one problem and another one pops up. Take the tax overhaul. The corporate tax rate dropped from 35% to 21%. The intention? Companies grow, create jobs, wages go up. But tariffs would raise the cost of steel and aluminum, eroding that. Veronique de Rougie is with the Mercatus Center.
On one hand, you put in place a policy that grows the economy, and on the other hand, you put also a policy in place that reduces economic growth.
De Rougie says the tariffs could also eat into some of the economic benefits of the tax overhaul for individuals by raising prices on consumer products. And speaking of those tax cuts, they conflict with another White House goal.
Tax cut raises the deficit immediately.
Joseph Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the Trump administration claims lower taxes will grow the economy and pay for themselves. But right now, we've got a ballooning deficit.
Cut taxes, higher budget deficit. Just arithmetic.
Now, some conflict in government is normal. Jack Pitney, professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, says, for example, the Agriculture Department might go to bat for tobacco farmers while the Surgeon General is urging people not to smoke. But Pitney says the depth of conflict in this administration, with policies canceling each other out, is unusual.
Trump seems to be a stranger to the idea of trade-offs. Every policy has a cost, and some policies work against each other.
And Pitney says eventually you can end up with policies that are just incoherent. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
With Gary Cohn's looming departure from the White House, the meeting he had been working on, CEOs of steel and aluminum using companies explaining to the president why they're opposed to his tariffs, is obviously off. We, though, know a steel company CEO who is always good to talk to get some insights from. Lisa Goldenberg is her name. She is the president of the Delaware Steel Company. Lisa, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you.
I have to tell you, when this news broke last week, everybody around here was like, oh, we got to call Lisa. We got to call Lisa. And I'm like, you know what? Let's let this sit for a little bit and get her a chance to think about it. And then we'll get her on the phone. So here we are on the phone.
Well, I have to tell you that wherever I go, people have been saying to me, when's Kai calling you? I wait, strangers. I am in Arizona and two people walked up to me in the lobby whom I've never met. And said, are you Kai's steel lady?
Oh,
so there you
gosh.
Go.
Well, there you go. So now that we got you on the phone, that's a great story. What do you think?
Well, it's an exciting time. For my company, tariffs are a good thing, but I wear a lot of hats, as you and I have discussed. Yeah. I think this is the kind of thing, what's good for the goose is not necessarily good for the gander. So when we talk about manufacturing, just to give a primer and take it back a step, traditional big steel mills where the steel is actually made, this is very, very good for big steel. There's manufacturers, and that's where we get into a tricky part. I sell into what we call non-residential construction. So that's big box stores and what you see in your community. Those prices on the goods that I sell, the companies who manufacture product, have gone up 30% overnight.
Wow.
So are they will continue to rise. They will continue to rise.
Are your clients coming to you and saying, Lisa, you're killing me here. I can't pay this. I'm going to have to pass this on to my customers.
Absolutely, 100%. And when Wilbur Ross goes on television talking about the price of a can of Coke, I honestly, he's a guru, and I highly respect him in what he does. I have no idea what he's talking about. Right. I'm charging manufacturers 30% more in the last 2 weeks, and I will continue to raise that number. I will be in the market. I'm a warehouse, but I'm also a trader. So I pass on not all, but most of it as soon as I can. Of the increase, the increase.
Are you, as the CEO of a steel company, are you hiring? Are you going to expand?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic. We will have a very strong quarter. This is where you make, this is a once in a lifetime. This is where you make money. The question is, when this, quote, falls apart, when this changes, I don't want to be left with extraordinarily high-priced inventory. So I need to be extra, extra cautious. Let's remember, there are no new tariffs. This is a conversation.
Right. It sort of sounds like, when you're using words like when this falls apart, it sounds like either you think these tariffs might not be all that they're going to be cracked up to be, or like President Bush, they're going to go into place, there will be WTO conversations and European retaliation, and they're going to be pulled back.
Of course they're going to be pulled back, and they may be pulled back before they even happen. We will have tariffs. It might be a way to negotiate NAFTA. It's old and antiquated. Maybe this is a negotiation strategy. The president negotiates with a very big stick. So you go in with a lot of drama. People freak out. Now you sort of negotiate. So at the end of the day, we will have tariffs. Do I think they will look like what's proposed? No, I do not.
Lisa Goldenberg at the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon, huh?
You bet. Thanks so much.
Told you she was always great to talk to. Those worries last night about what the markets were going to do today now that Gary Cohn's leaving? Please. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's an item that in most other weeks would be getting a whole lot more attention. A Senate bill to roll back some of the banking restrictions that were put in place after the financial crisis is moving forward with bipartisan support. 17 Democrats have voted alongside Republicans to allow a floor vote on the thing. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has this latest episode of Today in Dodd-Frank Rewrite.
Ever since Congress enacted Dodd-Frank 8 years ago, the banking industry has been arguing it goes too far, that onerous regulations are putting smaller rural banks out of business.
We're losing a bank a day in our country. We have been for a few years.
Kathy Underwood is CEO at Ledyard National Bank, a community bank in New Hampshire. She thinks the Senate bill is necessary.
It's not the perfect bill, but boy, it goes a long way in helping reduce some of those overhead costs.
Among many other things, the bill changes the threshold for which banks are subject to stricter oversight, like capital requirements and stress tests. Right now, more rules kick in for banks with more than $50 billion in assets. The Senate bill raises that threshold to $250 billion. Most community banks hold less than $10 billion. Katie Milani at the left-leaning Roosevelt Institute says less oversight is a step in the wrong direction.
This is not just targeting and relief for small banks. These are banks that are up to $250 billion. So these are names like American Express, SunTrust. These are big banks.
Large parts of the banking bill deal with housing regulation and mortgage finance, some of which worries Aaron Klein at Brookings. The bill would exempt 85% of banks in the country from new requirements to provide information about racial disparities in mortgage lending.
This will lead to lower quality data, which in turn means that some instances of racial disparity in lending will go unchecked.
The Congressional Budget Office says the bill could slightly raise the probability of the failure of a major financial institution. It could get a final vote on the Senate floor this week. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
We're going on 6 months now since Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. 1 in 7 people on Puerto Rico are still living without power. And nobody knows for sure how many people have left for the mainland permanently, but estimates do put it somewhere between 1% and 2% of the pre-storm population. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on what Puerto Ricans who chose to remain and help rebuild might be up against.
The Puerto Rico Department of Education is surveying kids from third grade on up and their teachers, trying to determine which areas need counselors and social workers most. Charles Vinatier Santiago teaches Puerto Rican law and politics at the University of Connecticut. He's from Puerto Rico, has family on the island. He was there last week.
The conversation centered around the impact of not having a reliable electricity and then the stress that their parents are experiencing because of lack of work or lack of living conditions.
He says depression is palpable, especially in lower-income communities.
I witness a lot of sort of violent behavior by parents. Parents are just burnt out.
The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority was defaulting on bond payments even before the hurricane. The governor, Ricardo Rosselló, has suggested privatizing it. Kate Long runs a research service for Puerto Rico bondholders. She thinks finding a buyer is going to be tough.
You know, you have a car and then you run it. You never change the oil, right? You let all your dopey friends drive it into, you know, into ditches. And then you said, well, forget it. I'm just going to sell it. That's basically what they've done with the power company.
Puerto Rico's estimated debt before the storm was somewhere between $75 and $200 billion. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says funds holding Puerto Rican debt face taking a serious loss. As for the Puerto Rican government,
they've got to be much more aggressive in reforming. And if, but only if, they're able to do that, they're going to need substantially more support from the mainland.
But many Puerto Ricans are done waiting. The Puerto Rican government says it estimates another 200,000 residents will move from the island to the mainland before 2018 ends. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We're out with the latest version of the Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll today. It's installment number 6, I think. Lots of interesting stuff in there that we'll get on the air in the next couple of days, including who we all think should get the credit for how the economy is doing. Politicians, we know, including a certain incumbent, aren't shy about taking said credit, and they are given their share by some of our poll respondents. Most Americans, though, say the private sector deserves to take a bow. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
In our poll, 62% of people optimistic about the economy say the private sector deserves credit. That's more than 10 points higher than President Trump and President Obama, and almost 30 points higher than Congress. Kim Peraski is an independent voter in eastern Pennsylvania. She works a good bank job, and she says private business and workers tell the story of a good economy and a good stock market.
People, like, you know, investing their $20 a week more that they got, you know, investing in a 401. Yeah, they got a tax cut, but they're the ones that are making the stock market work, the American people and other businesses, private businesses.
Democratic-leaning Ryan Wagner, a 30-something in the Portland, Oregon area, agrees. He says the building and construction near him are happening despite the president, whose position on immigration is politically uncertain. For instance, he says, imagine you run a computer company and you're hiring workers.
And you are expecting to be able to have some of those be immigrants. How would you be able to accurately predict in the next 5 years that you would be able to recruit people? Because there's no clear direction.
To be clear, many I talked to wanted to say that both the private and public sectors matter, which is what most economists say. Private firms tend to create jobs and growth, but the government provides price stability and infrastructure and peace and safety. It's a matter of degree.
Everything is government.
Retiree Ernest Parker Jr. in southeastern Virginia calls himself mostly Republican. He gives the private sector only some credit for a bustling economy, which in his area shows up in the form of traffic.
There's five different big military installations in this area, and then the contractors that work for them or with them. If you took the government out of here, Chesapeake, Norfolk, Virginia Beach would be nothing.
And some respondents give the private sector hardly any credit. Republican Norman Ingold is another retiree in northern Ohio. He says hiring is good, the stock market's going crazy, and to him, the president's policies make it happen.
I kind of like the way the Trump administration has shaken things up a little bit. I have to give him and his administration credit.
Now, fewer than half the respondents in our poll agree with him. This is the first time the question's been asked this way, so there's no trend to examine. But even in this, shall we say, politics-heavy year, most of those polled think the private sector is the key economic engine. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You can dig into the poll's results to your heart's content. Marketplace.org is where it lives. Also, while you're there, check in on the update to our Economic Anxiety Index. Coming up.
You have people using sandpaper, power tools, chemicals.
It's not easy to get your blue jeans to look so good, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 82 points today, about 0.3%, 24,801. Gary Cohn, who's Gary Cohn? The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 0.3%, closed at 73.96. The S&P 500 down a single point. We will call that flat, 27.26. Fears of tariff retaliation depressed stocks with heavy international exposure today. Plane maker Boeing dipped about 0.5%. Caterpillar burrowed down 1.4%. Brown-Forman, owner of the Jim Beam bourbon brand, slid 5.6%. Harley-Davidson down 0.9% after the European Union threatened to stick tariffs on U.S. bourbon and motorcycles, as you might have heard. Bond prices fell just a touch. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note pretty much steady, 2.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Not great news for the UK today. The European Council, which is one of the European Union's main governing bodies, it laid out its guidelines for the next phase of the Brexit talks, and it turns out the EU is starting to play hardball. It said any new European trade deal with Britain is going to make that trade more complicated and more costly than it is today, and that Britain and its European trading partners are going to suffer. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports the message was unwelcome but not unexpected.
Oddly enough, for a country famous for its culinary shortcomings, much of the language of Brexit has been related to food.
Cherry picking is not an option.
EU negotiator Michel Barnier chiding Britain for trying to pluck only the choicest fruits of EU membership, while British critics like opposition lawmaker Caroline Lucas complain that the government is trying to hog the benefits of both leaving and remaining in the bloc.
Can I suggest to the Prime Minister that having your cake and eating it isn't a serious strategy for Brexit?
And former British trade official Sir Martin Donnelly, also resorting to gastronomic metaphor, warns Brexit could entail, in trade terms, a crash diet.
You're giving up a three-course meal for the promise of a packet of crisps in the future.
The government says Britain must leave the EU. That's what the majority voted for in the referendum. It must take back control of its borders, laws and money from Brussels, while retaining frictionless trade with the EU, its largest trading partner. In a keynote speech last week, Prime Minister Theresa May insisted Britain isn't trying to have its cake and eat it too.
Life is going to be different. In certain ways, our access to each other's markets will be less than it is now.
But in seeking a special free trade deal with the EU, she made no apology for trying to retain many of the benefits of belonging to the bloc while trying to discard the disadvantages.
If this is cherry-picking, then every trade arrangement is cherry-picking.
Britain would adhere to some EU regulations, she said, and continue paying some money into EU coffers. She called for EU concessions in return, especially since the bloc has a trade surplus with Britain worth $110 billion.
We have a shared interest in getting this right. So let's get on with it. Thank you.
But there was no applause from Brussels. Today, President of the European Council Donald Tusk gave this frosty response.
Our agreement will not make trade between the UK and the EU frictionless. It will make it more complicated and costly than today for all of us. This is the essence of Brexit.
Publishing guidelines for the next phase of the Brexit negotiations, Tusk said there could be a free trade deal with Britain, rather like the one the EU recently struck with Canada. But he offered no special access for Britain's all-important finance industry, and he firmly rejected May's discreet attempt at cherry-picking. He said Britain should not get any of the benefits of EU membership after it's left the bloc.
A pick-and-mix approach for a non-member state is out of the question. We are not going to sacrifice these principles. It's simply not in our interest.
After all, they don't want to tempt other member states to head for the exit. The Brexiteers are undaunted, though. And back to the food metaphor, Cabinet Minister Michael Gove talks of a recipe for success. Britain freeing itself from the table d'hôte, or fixed menu, of EU membership and striking its own free trade deals around the world.
Instead of having, if you'll forgive me, the table d'hôte the European Union insist on, then we can dine à la carte across the globe.
In other words, after Brexit, the world will be Britain's oyster. Cynics point out that seafood does have a tendency to go bad. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This is clearly Manufacturing Week here at Marketplace. We talked yesterday about Adidas and its new high-tech factory that's cranking out sneakers faster and more profitably than ever before. Today, blue jeans, Levi's by name. Levi Strauss, technically. They literally invented jeans. Anyway, you know the look that some jeans have? Holes and fading and strategically placed tears? The company is going to start doing them with lasers instead of labor. Suzanne Kapner wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe I need to understand how jeans are made, and I guess distressed is the word, right? How's it done now?
Well, the sort of the old-fashioned way is very labor-intensive. First, you have to wash the denim, and, you know, they're cut and sewn, and obviously you create the pants. But then to get this sort of this worn look that's become very popular, you have people using sandpaper, power tools, chemicals, you know, just rubbing the jeans. They rub off thin layers of the fiber. They create the holes, the so-called whiskers around the pockets, and it's very labor-intensive and time-consuming.
And now Levi's is working on lasers.
That's right. And they're not the only ones doing this. There is a big trend in garment making to automate these factories. And lasers have been used now for several years. But the innovation that Levi's is bringing is that with their laser technology, there will be no manual application required. Now, with the sort of the less advanced lasers that are out there now, you still needed humans to do some finishing. The lasers were not sufficient to do the work on their own.
So now we have lasers smart enough to actually make a pair of blue jeans look good. Is that the basic gist?
Yeah, the technology is good enough so that they, you know, you can sell them and they're saleable. But in the past, not so much.
So let's cut to the bottom line here. How long does it take a person to distress a pair of blue jeans?
About 20 minutes.
And if I've got a laser, I can zap it out in how much?
90 seconds.
Wow. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So the bottom line benefits here are clear.
Well, clearly there are cost benefits, but it goes way beyond that. What Levi's has told me is, you know, a lot of companies are working on sort of improving their supply chain, with the end result being they don't want markdowns at the end of the season. And you have markdowns. Right now, companies have to order sometimes 18, 24 months before the goods actually hit the floor. And it's so hard to predict what consumers are going to want. You know, as you close that gap, you have a better chance of matching supply and demand and getting it right. So that's kind of what's driving a lot of these innovations.
Right. It's all about inventory control, right? If you have a shorter supply chain, you can better control your inventory and thus have less left at the end of the season you have to sell for cheaper, right?
And that's been the secret behind Zara and other fashion chains, why they've been so successful.
Yeah. Consumers of blue jeans, are they going to see a price break since it's now, in theory, cheaper for Levi's and these other companies to make these things?
Levi's tells me no, not much of a price differential. And that's that's not why they're doing this. They're not expecting to lower prices with this technology.
Suzanne Kapner writes for The Wall Street Journal, most recently on Levi's and other companies and lasers making your blue jeans. Suzanne, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Final note on the way out today, which I offer without any real-life experience in the subject at hand, but which empirically makes total sense. A headline in the Washington Post's style section that says, "High heels are the worst and women are finally ditching them." Sales of high heels, the paper reports, dropped 12% last year. That's according to data from the NPD Group. Sales of women's sneakers, up 37%. Go figure. All right, we got to go. Dow Jones Industrial Average off 82 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ up 24, 0.3%. S&P 500 was flat. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.